What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is political philosopher and author Michael Walzer, whose new book is In God's Shadow, Politics in the Hebrew Bible. We'll also have visits from our Too Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom, it's Tisha B'Av today when we commemorate the destruction of both the first and second temples on the sad ninth day of the Hebrew calendar month of Av. On Tisha B'Av, we fast and chant the powerful book of Echa, Lamentations from the Bible, and remember not only these destructions, but other terrible events that occurred around this day. The Battle of Beitar, in which the Romans defeated and annihilated the army of Shimon bar Kochba in the year 135. The expulsion of the Jews from Spain in 1492, and other such tragedies. It is not a date of joy or celebration. But in light of the fact that today these cataclysms of the past have been submerged somewhat behind the dynamic success of the modern state of Israel, now in its 65th year of a pretty healthy existence, Tisha B'Av remains important, but not focal. On a personal level, I can tell you that fasting on Tisha B'Av is just about the most difficult of the official fasts on the Jewish calendar, because in the summer, days are long and hot, and going without food and water until 8 at night or so seems worse than starting a fast earlier and ending it earlier, as we do for Yom Kippur. Jews today, both in the diaspora and within Israel, know that the great temple of our people in Jerusalem was destroyed twice, once by the Babylonians in the year 586 BCE, and once by the Romans in the year 70. But not too many know much about Bar Kochba, or the fall of the fortress of Beitar, 65 years after the supposed end of Jewish sovereignty, until the founding of the State of Israel in 1948. In fact, on a historic level, I can tell you that today in Israel, the name Beitar signifies one of two things for most Israelis, soccer and a city near Bethlehem. If they are scholars of modern Zionism, Israelis might recall that Beitar was the political party founded by Zev Jabotinsky, father of right-wing politics in Israel, and many bemoan the loss of historical memory symbolized by Beitar, the tragic end of the truly final Jewish country, for another 1,800 years. But I actually think it's a positive note that Israelis remember their contemporary losses far more proactively than these ancient ones. If Yom HaShoah, Holocaust Remembrance Day, and Yom HaZikaron, the day we remember those who fell in Israel's wars in defending the modern state, are more important to today's Jews, well and good. It's not that we should forget our tragic past, but it is far more important to remember our vital present and our recent heroic past. Then we can continue to prepare for a vibrant future, even on a sad day like Tisha B'Av. The London Olympics have begun, and without a moment of silence or a formal official remembrance of the events 40 years ago in Munich, in which 11 Israeli athletes and officials were murdered by Palestinian terrorists. Each Olympic year, the Israelis and others request such a moment, and each time the International Olympic Committee ignores it. In doing so, it holds to the now time-honored arrogance of Avery Brundage. May he rest, I'm not sure about in peace. The hypocritical head of the Olympic movement in 1972, who did virtually nothing to acknowledge the murder of Olympic athletes kidnapped from the Olympic Village during the Olympic competition. After the terrible events unfolded in that sad September of 1972, concluded with the helicopter shootout that the world and many of us personally watched, a memorial service was attended by 80,000 spectators and 3,000 athletes in the Olympic Stadium in Munich. IOC President Brundage made almost no reference to the murdered athletes during his speech praising the strength of the Olympic movement, and somehow equating the attacks on the Israeli athletes with the arguments about encroaching professionalism or disallowing Rhodesia to participate in the Games, which outraged everyone of intelligence and conscience. The victims' families, the Israeli victims, were represented by Andre Spitzer's widow, Anke, and Moshe Weinberg's mother, and a cousin of Moshe Weinberg, Carmel Eliash. And during the memorial service itself in 1972, Eliash collapsed himself and died of a heart attack. During that service, the Olympic flag was flown at half-staff, along with the flags of most of the other competing nations at the request of Chancellor Willy Brandt. 10 Arab nations, however, objected to their flags being lowered to honor murdered Israelis, and so their flags were restored to the top of their flagpoles almost immediately. Will Daume, the president of the Munich Organizing Committee, sought to cancel the remainder of the Olympic Games, but in the afternoon, Brundage and others who wished to continue the Games prevailed, saying they could not let the incident halt the Games. As Brundage said, the Games must go on, and we must continue our efforts to keep them clean, pure, and honest. Yeesh. The decision was endorsed by the Israeli government and Israeli Olympic team chef de mission, Shmuel Lalkin, at the time. On the 6th of September, 1972, after the memorial service, the remaining members of the Israeli team withdrew from the Olympic Games and left Munich. All Jewish Olympians were placed under guard. Mark Spitz, the great American swimming star who had already completed his competitions and won a then-record 9 gold medals, left Munich during the hostage crisis. It was feared that as a prominent Jew, Spitz would be the next kidnapping and murder target. As American marathon runner Kenny Moore said, quoting Dutch distance runner Jos Hermans, "You give a party and someone is killed at the party, you don't continue the party. I'm going home." The families of some victims asked the IOC to establish a permanent memorial to the athletes, but the IOC has continually declined, saying that to introduce a specific reference to the victims would alienate other members of the Olympic community. And so, at least at the Olympics, again, the terrorists win. You know, as a kid growing up, I loved everything about sports, and the Olympics were the biggest sports event in the whole world. I was 11 when this happened. But after the Munich massacre, I have never had anything like the same feeling for the Olympic Games, not even when America saved the Olympic movement from its own incompetence and corruption at the LA Olympics of 1984 in my hometown, nor even when I attended the opening ceremonies at the Mitt Romney Winter Salt Lake City Games in 2002. And the continued absence of any acknowledgement or memorial at these historic commemorations, like the 40th anniversary of the Munich attack by Palestinian terrorists, makes it pretty easy to continue to not care. If they don't care about their own ideals, why the heck should anybody else? Still, that fanfare tune is pretty good. When we come back on Too Jewish in just a few moments, we'll meet our guest, the outstanding intellectual Professor Michael Walzer of Princeton University and Harvard, who has written on philosophy and politics and Israel and many of the most important subjects and ideas of our time. Now he has explored the politics of the Hebrew Bible. Find out why and how when we come back in a few moments on Too Jewish.
Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza. I love the fact that when people come into Mama's, they feel right at home. For example, a lot of times they'll walk up to the counter and give a shout out to my nephew Vinny, or they'll see Liz and ask her about the kids. The truth is, people feel at home at our restaurants because that's how we feel about our restaurants. But Tucson's a big town, and there's still a bunch of people who haven't experienced Mama's friendly atmosphere yet. They don't know that the Spina family opened the first Mama's back in 1980, or that our pizzas are made from the freshest ingredients, or that our sauce goes all the way out to the edge, or that we have an absolutely huge pizza called the Mama's Family Size Pizza. So whether you're a Mama's regular or a newbie, we invite you to come on home to Mama's Family Style Pizza, calzones, and hero sandwiches. We've got 4 convenient locations that you can find on the web at mamasfamous.com. Now repeat after me, Mama's Pizza.
Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We're delighted to welcome to Too Jewish the renowned Jewish intellectual Michael Walser, a political philosopher, professor emeritus at the Institute for Advanced Study at a small school called Princeton. He is the editor of Dissent, an intellectual magazine that he's been affiliated with since his years as an undergraduate at Brandeis University, 10 or 15 years ago, right?
right.
He has written widely on just and unjust wars, nationalism, ethnicity, radicalism, tolerance, contributing editor of The New Republic, my favorite Jewish publication, although people don't think of it as Jewish, and has written a number of books, including the new book, In God's Shadow, Politics in the Hebrew Bible. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, a quick question. It's a balancing act to some degree, I would think, being so obviously identified as an academic and also obviously identified as an authority on a variety of Jewish subjects. How do you do it?
I don't think of it as balancing. An awful lot of professors are Jewish.
Okay, it's not a prerequisite to be Jewish, but
right.
Seems
right.
Right.
And for many years, I did teach standard political theory courses and didn't include Maimonides, say, as perhaps I should have done. It was rather late in life that I got involved in systematic work on Jewish subjects, and I had to spend quite a lot of time giving myself the education that I hadn't gotten as a kid.
What prompted you to begin to explore those Jewish aspects more deeply?
Well, a number of things. First of all, you just get tired sometimes of John Locke and Hobbes and Rousseau and but also the Jewish tradition became a central subject of Israeli politics. And it seemed to me that that Jews all around the world should involve themselves in this enterprise. What is the future of Jewish politics now that we have solved or escaped the Jewish question through citizenship in Western democracies and sovereignty in the Middle East? And it seemed to me that that the one way to move forward was to challenge the claim of Orthodox and ultra-Orthodox Jews in Israel that they had a kind of monopoly control of the Jewish tradition. And so I went to work with colleagues in Israel to produce this what will be four volumes looking at the Jewish political tradition, collecting texts and commenting on them, and making this tradition available to people who haven't had a yeshiva education.
Fascinating project. We will talk much more about that with Michael Walser when we return on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers,
Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism of Kvetch or Akfel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming them there, or download us from the Apple iTunes Store as Popular Jewish Podcasts. The terrible Bulgarian bus bombing in Burgas last week reminds me of a powerful and very sad Yehuda Amichai poem. For it was not just five Israelis who were murdered that Wednesday morning, half a world away. Our poetry moment today comes from the great Israeli poet Yehuda Amichai. It's called The Diameter of the Bomb. The diameter of the bomb was 30 centimeters, and the diameter of its effective range about 7 meters, with 4 dead and 11 wounded. And around these, in a larger circle of pain and time, two hospitals are scattered and one cemetery. But the young woman who was buried in the city where she came from, over 100 kilometers away, enlarges the circle considerably. And the solitary man who weeps over her death in the distant corner of a far country by the sea encompasses the whole world in the circle. And I won't even mention the crying of orphans that reaches to the throne of God, and from there onward, making the circle without end and without God. That was Yehuda Amichai, translated from the Hebrew by Yehuda Amichai himself and Ted Hughes. May the memories of the victims in Bulgaria be a blessing.
We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Guy.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
Unfortunately, you have a cast on your arm. Tell us how that happened.
Well, I went to Israel, and I thought I should check if gravity works in Israel. Apparently it does. Surprise, surprise. And I slipped in a trail with the men's mission, with the Federation men's mission. We went to a cave called the Alma Cave. And I was telling men, watch your step, it's very slippery. And the next thing I know, I was flying through the air, landing on a rock, and broke my arm.
You were demonstrating.
Exactly, exactly. Just out of goodwill.
Yes, of course.
Interesting thing that I noticed after breaking my arm, I went in Israel to, you know, to get medical care. As a kid growing up in Israel, I remember the medical care as being something, you know, really annoying. You needed to stay in lines for hours until someone would treat you and so on and so forth. And this time I was extremely surprised. I came to it, it's called Kupat Cholim Klalit. It's one thing that people might want to know about Israel. Israel health insurance is very different than the US. In a sense, maybe the Obamacare that people talk about now is to an extent moving the U.S. a little bit towards the system that works today in Israel.
Kind of socialized medicine, but not exactly.
It's a socialized medical system that has three layers. The first layer is a tax that you are committed to pay and gives you the basic health insurance, but it's not very basic. It's actually, in compare, like most of the health insurance that you would buy in the States today. It covers you for everything. Then you can choose to be a member of the Kupat Cholim, which is very, very cheap, very, very subsidized, and give you all the external levels of surgery and any healthcare that you can basically imagine. And on top of that, there is a third layer that is more expensive, but is really, you know, it's like a the cherry on top
on the sundae.
It's
right.
Only for medical care that you can't get in Israel, which is very rare, and that you need to be flown out to Europe or to the States, and that's like private. That you need to buy privately. If you choose, most people don't. So I came to the doctor in Israel, and it amazed me because it took less than 3 hours from the point where I entered the hospital to the point where I came out of the hospital with the cast on my hand, with all the diagnostic, with all the medicine, with everything. yesterday or several days ago, I went to the doctor here to, you know, to recheck the cast, replace the cast for something more convenient. And, you know, I came to the doctor, and he was an amazing doctor here in Tucson. And the waiting room was very fancy, much more luxurious than the one in Israel, with nice couches and stuff. But I ended up waiting over an hour before they even saw me. Although, you know, I had signed up and for 3 o'clock.
An appointment,
and everything. It took them until 4 until they actually saw me. And they didn't really need to do much. It was only rechecking a cast that I already had. And that made me think, you know, it's amazing. It's amazing that on one hand here, yeah, they respect you as if you are, you know, at least the king of Saudi coming to their place. But at the end of the day, the treatment you get takes by far longer time. And I'm not convinced that on the medical level is truly better than what you get in Israel. The guy here was actually very surprised that they identified the broken bone. He told me, you know, it's very hard to see the broken bone on the original
x-ray.
I'm sure that the doctor that treated you was very professional if he was able to identify that. That's very surprising. And he was just one of the guys there, one of the doctors. So that's something interesting that I came out of this unfortunate event of breaking the hand.
Yeah, very interesting. We had a kid who needed medical care when we were in Israel, and the doctor came to the hotel, treated him. The cost was very modest, came back later, brought medicine himself. Not stuff you get so much in the United States these days. Thanks, Guy. We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom, and it's Tisha B'Av today.
Good morning, Rabbi, and yes, it is.
This is the most somber day, or certainly one of the most somber days on the Jewish calendar, commemorating the destruction of the temple, according to tradition, both the first temple by the Babylonians in 586 BCE and the second temple by the Romans in 70 CE. And then other dates are sort of appended to it. The expulsion of the Jews from Spain supposedly took place around this time in 1492. Other dates seem to pop up when you look online. Let's talk about Tisha B'Av a little bit.
Right. So one thing that most people don't know about Tisha B'Av is that, in fact, it's the end of a three-day mourning period that begins on the 17th day of Tammuz.
Three-week mourning period.
Three-week. That's what I meant. I'm sorry. It begins on the 17th day of Tammuz, which is a minor fast that nobody's ever heard of, unless they happen to be Orthodox.
When the walls of Jerusalem were breached,
right,
among other things.
And there's this period when a lot of Orthodox Jews don't eat meat. It's kind of like the Jewish Lent. And it ends with Tisha B'Av, which is a full fast, and we read the Book of Lamentations, and what are we lamenting, right? So for those people who don't take personally the destruction of either the First Temple or the Second Temple, we lament a whole series of events to which people around the world might be able to relate more easily. We lament the experience of always being in exile. We lament being a persecuted minority. We lament things that obviously didn't happen on a single day, like the Spanish Inquisition or the Crusades, but all the damage that these things, which lasted for centuries, did to Jewish homes, Jewish families, Jewish children, Jewish communities around the world. We, by tradition, append to the ninth day of Av, and we add them to a list of things that we think about, commemorate, whatever. And so one of the things that Tisha B'Av does, at least for me, is I never really observed it except at Camp Ramah in the summertime when we sit around on cement, cold cement floors, and we don't eat, and we don't do any of the normal things that make camp fun, because you're not supposed to have fun on that day. And it raises the question of memory in the Jewish experience and how we remember things, how we commemorate them, and how sometimes we give ourselves almost mnemonic devices like Tisha B'Av to hook a whole list of things to, whether they actually happen on that day or not. So, yes, the Holocaust, which lasted for several years, also included events that happen on the ninth day of Av. But we have, in fact, created a separate day to remember the Holocaust. But lots of these other things historically that are more remote in history, we simply append to this day and add them to events that are too distant to have a lot of personal meaning for most Jewish people today, like the destruction of the temple. And so it's interesting that this comes always in the middle of the summer, and people are out of school and often away from home, so they're not with their community. They're often not reminded of it. And it is, I think, good occasionally to remind ourselves of the importance of collective memory, collective commemoration, and collective lamentation.
You know, even when what we're remembering is as painful as the events that we tend to commemorate on Tisha B'Av, I agree with you in the importance of collective memory. It's also interesting that after the Holocaust, the rabbinical authorities, such as they were, felt that we should commemorate the Holocaust on Tisha B'Av too, and then the people decide there should be a different day.
Right.
And sometimes collective memory takes more than one occurrence a year.
And sometimes people overrule the rabbis.
Yes, which is kind of okay. Thanks very much, Tom. We'll talk next
week. See you next week.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. Erwin and Murray celebrated selling their raincoat business by going on safari in Africa. One night in the jungle, they were frozen in their tracks by an ominous low roar. "Murray," quaked Erwin. "I heard." "Sha! Look behind me. Tell me, what do you see? A lion? A tiger? A leopard?" "I should know," moaned Murray. "What am I? A furrier?" That was the old Jewish Joke of the Week special feature to Jewish Just For You. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the second portion in the book of Devarim, Deuteronomy, the remarkable Sedra of Vayetchanan in this final text of the Torah. Vayetchanan includes truly spectacular stuff. The Shema, the central statement of God's oneness in the world. Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu Adonai Echad. Hear Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Followed immediately in the same portion by the Ve'ahavta, the commandment to love God with all our hearts, minds, and strength. And as if that were not enough for one Torah portion, it also includes the recitation of the Ten Commandments, the Aseret HaDibrot, for the second time in the Torah. You know, if you were to rank Torah portions, you could easily put Vayetchanan at the top in quality of content. After all, a section that includes the essence of Jewish monotheism and the Ten Commandments, centerpiece of all Western ethics, is a spectacular weekly parsha. It's no accident that this powerfully affirming portion is read the week after Tisha B'Av, on Shabbat Nachamu, the Sabbath of Consolation, for we take comfort in our knowledge that morality and holiness can ultimately bring justice. So what more can anybody possibly tell us about these most famous texts of our tradition? The Shema itself is really just a simple sentence. Listen, Israel, God your Lord is only one. Straightforward, and one that should be easy to understand and accept. Wholeness, holistic oneness. So simple, in fact, that anyone could understand and embrace it. Although, of course, simple and true ideas often struggle for acceptance. Still, not a complicated concept, oneness. Although well over 3,000 years since we Jews first articulated the idea that God is one, far less than half the world's population actually believes it. But it is the text that follows the Shema in our Vayetchanan, the Ve'ahavta, that is the more subtle and in many ways more intriguing passage. For in that prayer we are commanded to love God. Ve'ahavta et Adonai Elohecha, love the Lord your God with all your mind, soul, and heart. You know, many things in life can be commanded, but love, it seems to me, is not one of them. So what does the Torah mean when it says we're commanded to love God? It's a strange idea, but a powerful one, for love is essentially a kind of unconditional way to give,
to focus attention and caring on another being. Loving God means paying attention to God's existence in our world, to God's oneness, to God's moral code for us. We express our love of God, our ahava, by demonstrating that we've learned how to listen, shma. For when we truly listen, we will know that we must act ethically and so love. In essence, loving God means that we're obligated to listen to and follow God's mitzvot, live ethical lives, and do so with energy and commitment. It also means that being good, morally good, is a form of love, perhaps the purest form of love. May we all find a way to express that love through the righteous actions of mitzvot commandments, and so come to affirm God in our world. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, the renowned intellectual, Professor Michael Walzer, will explain whether there truly is a Jewish politics when we come back on To Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114. We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
This has been a very rough time for terrible attacks on innocents. Last week in Aurora, Colorado, during the showing of the new Batman Dark Knight movie, a failing neuroscience grad student, James Holmes, murdered 12 moviegoers and wounded 58 more. Apparently, although Holmes was not Jewish, he did work as a camp counselor at Camp Max Strauss, a camp run by the Jewish Big Brothers Big Sisters in the L.A. area way back in the summer of 2008. Our prayers go out to the families of the victims of this senseless, horrifying act. And U.S. intelligence officials confirm that the suicide bomber terrorist responsible for the brutal, deadly attack on Israeli vacationers in Burgas, Bulgaria, that murdered 5 Israelis and 1 Bulgarian and wounded 34 more, was a member of a Hezbollah cell that was operating in Bulgaria, the Islamic terrorists. Senior American officials confirm that the current intelligence assessment is that the bomber, who struck on July 18th, a Wednesday, the 18th anniversary of the terrible Iranian attack on the Amia Jewish Community Center in Buenos Aires, Argentina, had been acting under broad guidance to hit Israeli targets whenever an opportunity presented itself. That guidance was given to Hezbollah, a Lebanese terrorist group, by Iran, the primary sponsor of the attack. The attacks were in retaliation, supposedly, for the assassinations of Iranian nuclear scientists, for which Iran has blamed Israeli agents, an accusation that Israel has neither confirmed nor denied. The murdered Israelis, Maor Harosh and Elior Price, Yitzhak Holanji and Amir Menashe and Kochava Shriki, ranged in age from 24 to 42 years old. This bombing comes amid heightened tensions over Iran's nuclear program, which Tehran says is for peaceful purposes, but Israel and the West and anybody intelligent believes is a cover for developing nuclear weapons. The U.S. and Europe imposed sanctions aimed at crippling Iran's vital oil industry this month, while Iran has sworn to exact revenge for the assassinations as well as for cyber attacks, successful ones, on its nuclear industry. A senior Israeli official says that the Burgas attack was part of an intensive wave of terror attacks around the world carried out by two different organizations, the Iranian Quds Force, an elite international operations unit within Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, as well as by Hezbollah. While the Burgas attack fit the modus operandi of Hezbollah, the Israeli officials say it was not clear whether the bomber intended to blow himself up or had what the official called a work accident, adding, "We will never know." Oops. The bomber had a fake Michigan driver's license. Looks like he was hanging out looking for a local target, and this popped up. He jumped on it, the official said, referring to a bus carrying Israeli tourists outside the airport in Burgas. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said the attack was carried out by Hezbollah, the long arm of Iran. The time has come for all countries that know the truth to speak it. Iran is the one behind the wave of terror. Iran is the number one exporter of terror in the world. Netanyahu added, a terrorist state must not have a nuclear weapon. True. Bulgarian authorities are working with the FBI, CIA, and Israeli intelligence services, and Interpol. Interior Minister Tsvetan Tsvetanov said that the FBI determined that the driver's license was fake and that the person described on the card did, of course, not exist. Speaking at the Central Synagogue in Sofia, home to most of Bulgaria's 5,000 Jews, James Warlick, the U.S. ambassador, expressed outrage and horror at the terrorist incident that happened in Burgas. The Speaker of Iran's parliament, Ali Larijani, however, criticized the U.S. for not condemning a bombing in Damascus the same day that struck at President Bashar al-Assad's inner circle, killing three senior defense officials. By not condemning the assassination in Syria, the Americans show that they believe in good assassinations and bad assassinations, he said. Sensitive response. Great analogy. In other news, 57 graves were desecrated in a Jewish cemetery in the central Hungarian city of Kaposvár last weekend. The mayor, Karoly Sita, said he was upset and disgusted. City officials said they hope to help police capture those responsible. The local Jewish community believes the act was motivated by racism, which, you know, it was. Monica Lamperth, an MP of the Hungarian Socialist Party, deplored the vandalism, expressed hope the culprits will be caught soon. An estimated 550,000 Hungarian Jews were killed during the Holocaust, and about 100,000 of the country's 10 million people today are Jewish. Finally, Moshe Silman, the desperately indebted Haifa man who set himself aflame last weekend as part of the social justice protest in Tel Aviv, died from the second and third degree burns over 94% of his body. In the years since 400,000 people filled Tel Aviv's Rothschild Boulevard last summer, most of them camping out, setting off a national protest movement, Silman, who was 57 years old, had become a fixture of demonstrations in Haifa. His self-immolation stunned and perhaps galvanized the protest movement, which has struggled to find its footing this summer. He sacrificed himself, his sister, Bat Zion Elul, who made the decision to take him off life support, said. He sacrificed himself for the sake of others, for those who are in the same position as him, who don't have anything. The son of Holocaust survivors, Silman had once run his own messenger service, but the business struggled after the Second Intifada. A little debt from the National Insurance Institute spiraled out of control. His application for public housing was repeatedly rejected. He later suffered a stroke and was declared disabled. Friends said he was on the brink of homelessness when he arrived at the Tel Aviv protest last Saturday night with gasoline and a suicide note. A very sad note. And that's the news of Jews around the world. We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Professor Michael Walzer. He is a prominent academic, political philosopher, public intellectual, and now really a scholar of Jewish politics and Jewish power throughout history. Walzer graduated from Brandeis University summa cum laude in 1956, went to the University of Cambridge on a Fulbright, and eventually got his PhD from Harvard in 1961 in government. He worked at Princeton and Harvard, has been a contributing editor to the New Republic, written widely, and has written at least 27 books. Is it 27 now?
That sounds like too many.
More than two dozen books and hundreds of articles and essays, which have appeared in many prestigious journals and many popular journals as well. His 2012 book is called In God's Shadow, Politics in the Hebrew Bible. Yitz Greenberg has advocated a certain doctrine of the necessity of Jewish power in a post-Holocaust world. It's no longer so much a necessity as a fact to some degree, isn't it?
Well, there is Jewish power in the state of Israel, and a lot of us wonder whether 2,000 years of powerlessness has prepared us or prepared Israeli politicians for what they now have to do. A lot of them seem to me, still to manifest a kind of galut mentality. They haven't quite graduated to statehood. They live in Israel as if it were a besieged ghetto and not a very powerful state. And they continue to believe that that all the world is against them, against us, when in fact Zionism has been a remarkable success, and we have a state that's very much like all the other states. And it has friends, and it has strategic allies who aren't quite friends, and it has states that don't give a damn, and it has enemies of little consequence, and it has some very serious enemies. And that's not unlike the world of states, which we have finally entered and need to get accustomed to being part of.
In studying the Jewish political tradition, you know, so many people think, as you noted, that yes, okay, we had some authority over ourselves, but that doesn't count. It does count to a degree, though, doesn't it?
Yes, yes. It's one of the myths of Zionism, of early Zionist writers, that that there was no Jewish politics from Bar Kokhba to Ben Gurion. But that is wrong. We really did have a political life, a quite remarkable political life, because we managed to sustain a national identity, a national existence. We managed to sustain a legal community for almost 2,000 years without sovereignty, without land, without, most of the time, without coercive power. And that is a remarkable political experience. And you have to assume that there were some people during those 2,000 years who knew what they were doing.
The transition, I mean, certainly it would be correct to say that we didn't have a military tradition of any depth from Bar Kokhba maybe to Ben Gurion.
Right. Right. There were Jewish generals in medieval Spain, for example. But
there's some others.
Right, right. But there were no Jewish armies in the service of a Jewish sovereign.
You've written substantially about just and unjust wars, about an ethic in wartime. That seems extremely important nowadays. Israel has a concept of the purity of arms, Torah HaNeshek, and you've written about that too. Can you tell us a little bit about your observations on their concepts of ethics in wartime?
Well, there is a very, very lively debate going on right now, has been going on for some years in the IDF and in Israel, about how to fight decently when you're fighting against enemies who hide among the civilian population and who aim at civilian targets. So that's a very lively debate, and most of it, some of it, draws on Jewish traditions, and most of it draws on international law and secular conceptions of justice in the conduct of war. Because there were no Jewish armies for 2,000 years, the halachic tradition with regard to warfare is quite radically incomplete. Rabbis in Israel haven't really caught up. So most of the discussion is carried on in terms that are independent of halacha. But it's a very intense debate, and it runs quite closely parallel to debates now going on in the U.S. Army, because both the U.S. Army and the IDF are fighting in what are now called asymmetric wars, where a high-tech army confronts a very low-tech insurgent force, which, as I said a minute ago, hides among civilians and fires at civilians. And the question of how you engage with these insurgents and what risks you impose on the civilians they are hiding among, and what risks, this is the crucial question, what risks you are prepared to take to reduce the risks you impose on civilians on the other side. Those are very, very difficult questions, and they're faced by the U.S. in Afghanistan, and they were faced by Israel in Gaza.
And maybe they still are faced by Israel in the West Bank, which isn't officially in rebellion, but...
Right, and they certainly would be in the case of a new intifada.
Sure. Or another invasion of Gaza, to one degree or another.
Yes.
Which is always a possibility. You've written substantially on toleration throughout history and into the contemporary world. Jews have enjoyed great toleration in America, unique in our long, long history. Do you think Israel offers the same kind of toleration? Do you see a guiding aspect to its society that reflects that?
Yeah, well, it's the comparison of Israel and the U.S. is a little complicated because Jews and other minorities are indeed tolerated, more than tolerated, accommodated in many ways in the United States, but none of us are a threat to the United States. Israel, given the 48 war and all the wars since, and given the actual existing state of war with Arab countries like Syria and Iraq, and given the rockets, et cetera, the problem of Israel's Arab population is far more difficult than the problem posed by Jews or Mennonites or Mexicans in the United States. Maybe the comparison shouldn't be with minorities in peacetime in the United States. It should be with the way German Americans were treated during World War I or Japanese Americans during World War II. And then Israel looks like a fairly remarkably tolerant country. Certainly Arab Israelis, Palestinian Israelis, as they now call themselves, are discriminated against in many, many ways. They are not equal citizens. On the other hand, they are not treated like enemy aliens or like Japanese American citizens were treated in World War II. So it's always been a difficult issue. Right now, the Israeli government is talking about drafting, conscripting Arab citizens into civilian service at the moment, not into military service, but even so, conscripting them, coercing them. And I would think that before you do that, you would want to make sure that you were spending as much money on Arab school children as on Jewish school children, and that you were spending as much money on public services in Arab towns and villages as you were in Jewish towns and villages. Clearly, Israel is not doing that right now. And so equal citizenship is still a visionary prospect.
Very interesting. You know, I just recently returned. I'm from California, and I recently returned from a trip to Hawaii. In California, they interned, of course, all of the many, many Japanese citizens during World War II. In Hawaii, where there was a great danger of sabotage, and at least in their minds, they didn't intern the Japanese citizens because there were too many of them.
Yeah. So,
there's a certain irony to the way we treat minorities in every society, isn't there?
Right. Right.
You wrote about politics in the Hebrew Bible. Give us just sort of a what was the most interesting or surprising aspect of that you discovered in preparing that book?
Well, there are many. I mean, this is the Hebrew Bible is written over 800 years, and that's like from the year 1200 to the year 2000 in Western history. So there are many, many different views of politics, and they were all preserved. It's a remarkably pluralist doctrine, pluralist collection. And that perhaps the most remarkable thing about it is that opposing views of monarchy, for example, were preserved. You know, there was no effort to harmonize them and to produce a single view. But what was most interesting to me was there is a persistent strain of anti-political opinion in the Hebrew Bible. A certain sense that politics is for the goyim. We don't need it. Think of the Israelites at the Red Sea. Pharaoh's army is approaching, and what do? Moses tells them, just be quiet, stand still, and watch the deliverance of the Lord. In the Sinai, when they are hungry, they don't need a Joseph. The Egyptians needed someone like Joseph to deal with famine, an administrator with a plan. In the Sinai, God takes care of Israel. They don't need a Joseph. Moses confronts political opponents, uprisings, murmurings against him in the wilderness years, and God just destroys the rebels again and again. Political maneuvering. You don't need political intelligence, prudence.
If God's going to save it all, then you don't really have to think about those things.
Right, right. And that's what Isaiah tells Hezekiah in the most famous moment in biblical history. The Assyrian army is coming, and Hezekiah is a very good king. He sends ambassadors to Egypt to ask for help. He strengthens the walls of Jerusalem. He digs a canal to bring a tunnel to bring water into the city, and Isaiah comes and tells him none of that. That's reliance on human effort, which is idolatrous. You should just have faith in God. Do nothing. Be quiet. Have faith in God. That is a biblical attitude. Obviously, Hezekiah is on the other side. He probably believed in something like that Protestant hymn, "Praise the Lord and Pass the Ammunition."
I want to thank Michael Malzer for identifying Isaiah with Pearl Harbor for us this morning here on Too Jewish. You can find his book, In God's Shadow, Politics in the Hebrew Bible. It's great. It's a serious book, but it's wonderful reading. Thank you for a great visit.
Thank you.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical playout.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be Ellen Cassidy, whose excellent new book is called We Are Here, Memories of the Lithuanian Holocaust. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or TooJewishRadio.com, our website, and like us on Facebook. Our playout this morning comes from the Israeli CD Lev Tahor, Sacred Music, from the Reform Congregation in Tel Aviv, Kehilat HaLev. It's called Zocher HaLevana, Remember the Moon. She who holds the power of faith remembers the moon in her heart. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week and a week, we pray, of peace.
Sod emuna bekocho, zocher alev. Lord.